Welcome back to Behind the Headlines from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Coming up in today's show, we'll hear from Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert on President-elect Donald Trump's press conference from last week. We'll also talk to business reporter Rick Rimmel. Rick joins us with a story on big box retailers that are shifting tax burdens onto homeowners. For our first story today, we'll go to investigative reporter Dan Egan. There's been little to no controversy surrounding the river of oil that flows through Wisconsin. Dan sat down with producer Aaron Coy, who also worked on the interactive elements for Dan's story.
I got the idea to do the story because I'd been following media accounts over in Michigan of what was going on in the Straits of Mackinac. And because I cover the Great Lakes, I thought I should write about that. But I'd been on leave from the paper for over a year. So when I came back, I decided that that was the first story I wanted to do. So I got into this project looking at the Straits of Mackinac. And the more I learned about the problems that people have with those lines running underneath the Great Lakes at the tip of the Michigan Lower Peninsula, the more I realized that if they shut those lines down, there's a good chance that that oil could be rerouted, and then where would it go? And an obvious answer is Wisconsin. So it went from being a one-part story about oil pipelines on the bottom of the Great Lakes to a two-part story about oil pipelines running through Wisconsin as well as along the bottom of the Great Lakes. It was broken up into a five-part series for print.
Lovely paper of ours. You kind of start off this first part in North Dakota and the parallels between what's going on with the Dakota Access Pipeline and how that affects the Great Lakes region. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I was in the middle of the project when we decided to go to North Dakota just because it was drawing so much public and media attention. And when I was looking at the numbers, it just left me scratching my head because it's a relatively small pipe compared to what we have in Wisconsin and what's proposed for Wisconsin. And, I mean, water is water, and it should all be protected. But the volume that we're talking about as far as exposure, if there were a spill, is really not even comparable. When you're talking about a spill on the volume of water that could be affected, but when you're talking about the Missouri River, which is a great river in the Great Lakes, it doesn't even compare, really, because 20% of the world's fresh surface water is here, and there's no place like it. So I just found it was interesting that that pipeline was just generating so much controversy. And it's hard to compare the Dakota Access Pipeline with the pipelines in the Great Lakes, because that's an issue out on the Great Plains that is about more than just one oil pipeline. It's about, you know, centuries of mistreatment of Native Americans. And while there are some of those issues here as well, this is mostly about oil and water and people's private property rights.
Mm-hmm. So we have these pipelines in Wisconsin cutting through under golf courses, under waterways, under football fields of high schools and people's driveways. Is there any benefit to having this oil run through?
If you drive a car, there is. Obviously, we need oil. The question is, how much oil do we need, and where should it come from, and what should our exposure be as a state to getting this oil to markets beyond state borders? Credit to Enbridge. I mean, not many people know about these lines. That means that they haven't been major, major problems on the order of, say, the Kalamazoo spill or the Exxon Valdez. I mean, if they're doing their job, nobody should know about them. The problem is that, like anything humans build, they eventually can break. And the network of pipes isn't getting any of existing pipes isn't getting any younger. And while Enbridge, I think, does a very good job of maintaining them, pipes break. They have broken, and they'll break in the future.
So focusing in where you started on this story, under the Straits, mm-hmm. these pipelines you said are 60-some years old?
Yes, they were built in 1953, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they've never been replaced. They've been maintained over the years, but they've had some issues with maintenance because the lake bed upon which they are laid has been eroding, creating gaps, unsupported stretches where the pipes are literally kind of bridging gaps in the lake bottom, and Enbridge has been working hard to fix those spans by building supports to keep the pipes from sagging and potentially cracking. They've built a lot of them, and hopefully they've built enough.
Yeah. So if that pipeline does crack, what could the scenario be for the Great Lakes?
It would be very bad. It would be like nothing that's ever happened in the Great Lakes. Probably nothing that's ever happened on this continent, because the Straits of Mackinac are a very unique place in the Great Lakes because of the volume of water that moves through. It's actually Lake Michigan flowing into Lake Huron. And then Lake Huron flows down the St. Clair River into Lake Erie, just like the Gordon Lightfoot song, and then it goes into Lake Ontario, and then it goes out to the ocean. The current in the Straits isn't consistent. Some days it's going east to west, but depending on weather and wind, that current can flow the opposite way. So you can get Lake Huron flowing into Lake Michigan for a brief period of time. Sometimes it goes north, sometimes it goes south, sometimes it goes east, sometimes it goes west. So if you get a spill in that spot, there is no predicting at this moment where it would go, but it could go very far, very fast, and cover a whole bunch of shoreline. And this is a pretty harsh environment to have all that oil loose in the environment. It's not like the Gulf of Mexico, where it will eventually, or it relatively quickly breaks down in the environment because of the temperature and the microbes and whatnot. In that water environment here, it's much colder and much more sterile, and therefore much more likely just to sit there until it's somehow scooped or scraped up.
Part one of Dan's story ran in Sunday's Journal Sentinel. It's also available at jsonline.com. His five-part series will continue to roll out every day, so be sure to pick up your paper to find out more. President-elect Donald Trump held a press conference in advance of his inauguration. The press conference came after the disclosure of an explosive but unverified dossier containing condemning information about the Trump campaign's relationship with Russia. What does this mean for Trump's relationship with his own party, as well as his relationship with the media? Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert joined opinion editor Dave Haynes with the answer.
Now we're joined by Craig Gilbert in Washington. Craig, thanks for being with us this morning.
Nice to be with you.
So, hard on the heels of this release of this rather lurid dossier, at least some details were released in the main media. BuzzFeed released all the details. Donald Trump had a press conference yesterday. So, what do you make of the sort of potential political fallout of the release of these documents, and how Trump handled it at the press conference?
Well, I think the short term fallout is not particularly harmful to Donald Trump. It's the kind of thing that, you know, for his critics and skeptics, confirms there were suspicions. But for his supporters, it's very easy to dismiss because it's totally unconfirmed. And while one media organization posted this, quote, dossier, most media organizations that actually had it in their possession declined to do so for all the obvious reasons.
Right.
But it does kind of set up this dynamic between him and the media where he will attack elements of the media that are critical or that are publishing negative information. A lot of the, quote, mainstream media is kind of caught in between. In this case, BuzzFeed, the outlet that published it, made a decision that other media outlets didn't make and in some cases were critical of. But you got a sense of this press conference of just how kind of chaotic and stormy and turbulent this whole relationship with the press and with the media. I even hesitate to use the word media because, as we all know, the media is a conglomeration of incredibly disparate elements. But how stormy and turbulent this relationship could be, as we saw in the press conference where you had A lot of noisy back and forth between reporters and the president-elect.
And the president-elect had his own cheering section, frankly, of aides, which I don't think we've seen before. It was quite the circus.
It is a circus.
He's got his
cheering section, and you've got sympathetic media, you've got unsympathetic media, and you've got media in between. So it's very hard, I think, for the average person to sort out, and people naturally are going to take their sides, depending on whether they like or don't like Donald Trump.
So you mentioned it's all unverified. We want to make that clear. It might be unverifiable, but one of the allegations contained in this document was that the Trump team had met with Russian officials prior to the election. Does that allegation, whether true or not, spur even more investigation by congressional investigators, whether they be Democrat or Republican? What do you think that means for the investigations that are ongoing into the Russian ties?
Yeah, so, I mean, one reason why it's hard to predict is because Trump's own party is kind of divided substantively on Russia, on Putin, and what our relationship with Russia should be. And you got a hint of that in the press conference where Donald Trump said we should be working with Russia to contain ISIS. I've talked to Republican lawmakers who don't think we can work with Russia to contain ISIS. Mm-hmm. Republican lawmakers are going to be torn between their desire to be supportive of a president in their own party, their fear of Trump's base, but also, in many cases, they have a long track record of being very critical of Russia and Putin, and they personally feel that Putin is an adversary, a thug, quote unquote. So this is, potentially one of the biggest wedges between Trump and lawmakers in his own party. It makes it hard to know, what happens to the investigative machinery in Congress, which is obviously controlled by Republicans and Republicans who have an interest in a smooth start to the Trump presidency.
So in the past, we've often seen a coordination in messaging, at least, between the White House and Congress when one party controls both. I don't get the sense so far we're seeing that coordination. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it's going to be a very mixed bag. I mean, I think if you're expecting it to be total chaos and disunity, I think that's not going to happen. I think they have a lot of common interests. I think Trump has an interest in the Republican Congress succeeding on a bunch of different issues and policies and vice versa. So they are going to be coordinating and collaborating and working together in many respects. But, a lot of Republicans just don't know what to expect. In fact, like people outside the Republican Party don't really know what they're getting with this president. They don't know what to expect from this president. That applies to both policy and politics. There are going to be substantive differences on foreign policy, on entitlements, on spending, and on style. So people like Paul Ryan, we saw how awkward it was at times for him during the campaign. It may not look quite like that this time around. They'll be working closely together on some things, but there are going to be moments, difficult and awkward moments between Republicans on the Hill and the Trump White House.
Well, the Trump White House begins work just about 1 week from now. So, Craig Gilbert, thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
Looking forward to that.
Avid listeners of our show can identify where that audio came from. It's from our weekly JS on Politics show. You'll find a full version of that show available on Audioboom, iTunes, and Stitcher Radio. Big box stores such as Menards are challenging the amount of property taxes their business should be charged. This is sending alarm bells through communities that benefit from the collection of those taxes. Business reporter Rick Rimmel talked to business editor Jim Nelson about this story.
Hi, I'm Jim Nelson of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and I'm here with business reporter Rick Rimmel.
Hi, Jim.
Hi, Rick. Rick's got a story coming up in the Journal Sentinel about big box stores, but it's not your conventional story about retail, big box retailers like Menards. What you got cooking, Rick?
Well, it's about taxes and how people place a value on these buildings that house these gigantic stores, which can be 150,000 or more square feet. That's really big. And there's a a growing debate over what the proper way to figure the value on these places is.
How much are those buildings worth? How much does it cost to build a Menards store?
Rule of thumb, I'd say, I don't know, $12, $15 million or so.
So these the store operators are making kind of an unusual argument, are they not?
They are. I mean, it will seem unusual to many people, I think. They're saying that you shouldn't look at the fact that this building houses an operating business, maybe even a thriving business. They're saying that has nothing to do with the value of the real estate. They contend that the way you should place a value on these properties is think of them as though they were vacant, basically, just the shell of a building. So instead of looking at a Menards or a Lowe's that's up and operating and running, you look at the prices that are commanded by empty, vacant, big box stores that sell for secondary uses.
And we've got many examples around the country of these empty big box stores, and some of them, like the old Walmart down in Greenfield, have been put to kind of unusual uses, right?
They have. And many of the secondary uses of big box stores are for other retail, but typically it's not the same level of retail as was in there in the first place. And then you get uses like this Walmart down in Greenfield. It was purchased by a church, and the church occupies part of the building. They rented out another part of the building to St. Vincent de Paul Society, which has a thrift store in there.
Yeah.
And the critics of the way the stores want to place values on their property call this dark store theory or the dark store argument. Sounds kind of like something out of Star Wars. Again, the idea is that should you value this property based on the fact that it's got a operating, thriving business in it, or are you just looking at the shell that's there?
And store operators around the state and around the Midwest have been going to court trying to reduce their property taxes.
There's been a wave of litigation in the last, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 months or so in Wisconsin. Menards alone has filed maybe 15, 16 lawsuits against municipalities contesting that they are assessing the value of their stores too highly. Lowe's is in on this, Shopko, others as well. And this all got going in Michigan a few years ago. And their courts have accepted the so-called dark store theory. And basically, I'm told that the values of virtually every big box store in Michigan have been sliced in half from what they were before, which means the amount of taxes that these stores are paying has been cut in half as well.
That must really freak out these municipal governments, especially smaller communities where all of a sudden you're not getting so much tax out of a major commercial employer.
Sure, of course it does, because that tax burden is going to get shifted to someone else. And
me?
It could be you, yeah.
You?
Yeah, me too. Anyone who owns a home, anyone who owns any kind of property. And there are quite a number of alarmed public officials in Wisconsin who are, worried about this.
Yeah. So what's next? Is there some effort to try to slow this down or reverse it?
Well, trend? Things are moving in the courts, of course, but a number of municipalities have been pressing for legislation to revise or make clear the standards on which these properties should be assessed. And in fact, we expect legislation, a bill to be introduced in the state assembly within the next month or two that is likely to at least try to make it difficult to use a vacant store, the sale of a vacant store, as a basis for placing a value on an operating store for property tax purposes.
I mean, it's kind of arcane stuff, but also it sounds like that could be really setting up for a fight because you've got all sorts of competing interests, not the least of which is the cost of doing business.
They're already fighting about it, and the fight will definitely continue as this moves through the legislature.
And I suspect you'll continue to cover it.
You bet we will.
Thanks, Rick.
You're welcome, Jim.
To read Rick's story, pick up today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel or visit jsonline.com/business. That's all for today's show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Join me next week as I walk you through the biggest headlines from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.